Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 869.EZ4510, certificate number 19345. Operation Just Cause.
How about if I'm Mr. Purple? I mean, that sounds good to me. I'll be Mr. Purple.
You're not Mr. Purple. Some guy on some other job is Mr. Purple. You're Mr. Pink.
Who cares what your name is?
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're Mr. White. You have a cool-sounding name. All right, look, if it's no big deal to be Mr. Pink, you want to trade?
Hey, nobody's trading with anybody.
Just cause what?
We used to do that joke in Blockbuster Video about once a week. There was a... Do you remember the early 90s thriller Just Cause with, I think, Sean Connery and Lawrence Fishburne?
No.
So I've never seen it either. But there was a plethora of these kind of bad Sean Connery thrillers in the early 90s, badly reviewed. And I would always grab that one and be like, hey, do you guys want to get this? And someone would say, why? And I'd say, just because. People loved it.
Yeah.
There's no apostrophe before the cause, though.
Yeah, I feel like my desire to make that joke and then your story makes me feel bad about my joke.
That's kind of why I wanted to give you the background. Do you remember this time, of course. In 1980s, Reagan era into the Bush era, early 90s, and with some Clinton hangover of just being excited about U.S. overseas military adventurism.
So
people could not get enough of that on cable news.
You know, I was the target audience for late 70s, early 80s military adventurism. But after the invasion of Grenada and the Falklands War, I transitioned into like a radical peacenik. And so all this stuff, I was no longer excited by it. I was enraged. I was protesting in the streets. I was one of the hippies that was out marching around.
Well, not me, John. I was supporting the troops.
I know you were. I know you were.
I mean, it's hard to imagine now because we now live in an era of constant, endless global war.
Yeah, isn't that great?
And it's fantastic.
I know.
Everyone loves it. There's no downside.
Me too. As an investor in several munitions factories, I am always interested in a new front.
We're always looking for military contractors to advertise on Omnibus. Mm-hmm. We're looking for Raytheon or somebody to buy some time.
If you want to put your new missile system on the Omnibus, just write us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
We will load you on the bus. And so it seems odd for people of this era, and I assume I'm speaking to a future war-ravaged Earth where they are still in the middle of endless global war.
Yeah, they're just listening to us between raids.
Right. Thank you, by the way. We appreciate being your voice of the Blitz or whatever. But there was a time not so long ago when the memory of Vietnam had faded a bit.
Mm.
And, I mean, not for anybody who was there.
Right. Not for anybody, not for us either.
For Gen Xers, the memory had faded a bit. And the... you know, the beginning of the current nightmarish war on terror had not happened yet. And so, and cable news, crucially, had just started 24-hour hegemony and needed content.
That's right.
It's content.
Within the first, 10 years of cable news.
Right. I don't know when Ted Turner, when did CNN start going around the clock?
Early
81 or something?
But the problem with it was that it had a half-hour loop that never changed, right? I mean, they would update little bits of it, but
it's just David Goodenow on headline news saying the same stuff every half hour.
It wasn't this con. It wasn't like a like news anchors standing there like real news, real time newsing you. It was, you know, it was pre-recorded.
It was like watching the Walter Cronkite 30-minute newscast over and over. And it makes me angry that that doesn't exist anymore. Like, you turn on headline news today, they haven't changed the name. Maybe it's HLN now, but it's just reruns of Cold Case. It's like reruns of true crime shows.
What, really?
From the 90s. Yeah. But they still, the CNN still calls the station HLN, but it just airs, you know, 20 cold cases in a row.
I remember watching CNN in those early days, just praying for something newsworthy. I mean, because for whatever reason, I you would watch 30 minutes of news and then it would recycle and you'd watch it again. Just the idea that it was happening, that if something did happen, if a plane crashed or a war started, that you'd be the first to know. It was super exciting.
We were the first people, I think, for whom foreign policy and natural disasters and stuff became real-time television entertainment. Yeah. And of course, that led to the end of the American experiment,
right.
Pretty much.
Right. Too bad for us now.
But it was super exciting back then to see, oh, what's going to happen to Mount Pinatubo? We'll get another update in half an hour.
Last night I logged onto Twitter to tell some jokes, and whatever the latest foreign policy disaster just rolled in as it was going down, and I felt that I had to comment, of course. And
we're recording this in early 2020 when we're at another, you know, in the endless series of flashpoints in the war on terror, which has not reduced my terror at all.
No, although
it's really kind of a war reinforcing terror.
Although, you know, the terror that Americans kind of like to experience personally isn't real. You know, like Iran,
the Babadook?
Iran, like the Babadook, Iran has no capacity to strike against the United States. What Iran is going to do is set off car bombs outside of embassies for the next 25 years. Mm-hmm. So as long as you don't go to an embassy or overseas, you're fine.
But what if you know anyone in one of the armed services?
As long as you don't know anyone
who's not
overseas,
expecting to be deployed to Iran anytime soon.
As long as you're not in the military or do not have a child that's going on foreign exchange or do not do business with any multinational corporation.
And that's okay.
Never go to the post office.
You and I are self-employed and live in Seattle.
And in a bunker.
We don't actually know that many people who are deployed.
We do. I got a lot of messages last night from people who are either deployed or have family or friends that are deployed. And it was shocking to me. A friend of the show who listens from his bunker said that a very close friend of his who's in the military police just went to Kuwait like 3 days
prior. Oh, I saw
prior.
That. He's like, she's over there now, and what can I do?
Yeah, she usually I have her back, but I retired, and she just went on like a milk run.
It's a lot less academic.
Yeah.
For hundreds of thousands of people. And also the 80 million people who live in Iran.
And
who are now going to find hardliners a much more appealing option.
The 400 million people that live in that region.
Right. Right,
who were already like, kind of amped up.
So really, it was really pernicious, this idea that the occasional Reagan-era military venture was a fun thing to watch on TV.
Were you in high school in 89?
Yes. Desert Storm / Shield.
Right.
Remember the Support the Troops, We Are the World, like that Kevin Costner engineered?
Yeah, sure.
But I can still sing it.
89 was also the Operation Just Cause,
yeah, 89 is Just Cause. So I guess Desert Storm, Desert Shield is 91. Yeah, that's true. I was in ninth grade in 89, and I remember really round-the-clock coverage of, because there was the U.S. invasion of Panama, and it had a neat three-act structure that our cable anchors loved. I mean, the seminal moment there is Bernard Shaw, John Holliman, and Peter Arnett under a coffee table at the Sheraton or whatever, watching the first bombs fall in Baghdad, and everyone just watching it like it was a video game with green night vision cameras. And Americans just eating it up.
Yeah, that was really a spoonful of sugar.
And the cool thing about all these military engagements is that they all ended about 4 days later in resounding victory. And we got used to the idea that when the U.S. declared war, it was good TV. And then it was over by the weekend.
The problem with Noriega is that he was such a tin pot dictator. It did not feel like he was worthy of that much American attention. And also, even then,
you wouldn't send in 30,000 guys for one drug lord?
Even then, yeah, his connection to drug money laundering and the way that that had all just recently played out in the arms for hostages sort of scandal of the Reagan administration, we all were very suspicious at this point about CIA and involvement in drug trafficking. And so it very much, the stink of conspiracy was on the invasion of Panama and particularly see, the code name Operation Just Cause. Really, it was a big, big cesspool.
See, this is your peacenik take. You and your buddies are already talking about how this is just a cover up. This is Ollie North all over again, man.
Well, it was, and this was the era when we were starting to recognize that the drugs from Panama get turned into crack and sown in the streets of American inner cities, creating an epidemic. You know, we were tying it all together.
George Bush was the first president with a crack dealer.
That's right.
As we've covered. So just to set the stage, in 1989, Manuel Noriega, the dictator of Panama, as you mentioned, had been a CIA operative. He had been our guy in the region for decades, but it turned out he was everybody's guy in the region for decades. Reagan's Secretary of State, George Shultz, said, you don't buy Noriega, you only rent him. He's like beer, apparently.
Ouch.
Because at the same time as he is happily taking a six-figure check from the CIA every year to advance American interests in Central America, because all we cared about back then, the form just had one question. It said, do you hate the Sandinistas?
Right.
And Noriega was like, wait, I get $150,000 a year? Oh, yeah. I hate the Sandinistas so much.
Hate them.
But as it turned out, he was also funneling aid to the Marxist rebels in El Salvador.
Wait a minute.
He was giving intelligence to Cuba and other Warsaw Pact nations.
Wait a minute.
It turned out anybody with an open checkbook, you know, Manuel Noriega became their best friend. And, you know, a few decades into his run as a U.S. CIA asset, he also became president of Panama and essentially dictator for life of Panama.
And we had recently had very complicated relations with Panama, American public relations-wise, because Carter had negotiated the transfer of the Panama Canal to Panama during the late 70s.
Leaving tens of thousands of U.S. troops based there, but yes, giving them back the canal zone.
Which was a very controversial thing, and it was, I mean, politically controversial in the sense that people on the right side of the spectrum felt like that was a betrayal.
I will never forget my seventh grade social studies teacher when we were doing Latin American history saying, I just remember the end of the sentence, until the canal was given back, thank you very much, Jimmy Carter. And with such venom in her voice suddenly, as she thought about her anger that the Panama Canal Zone was no longer American.
Well, you remember the bumper stickers that said, keep our canal, give away Carter?
I don't remember those.
There was I hope
someone sends us them.
Yeah. Keep our canal, give away Carter.
Please mail us your Panama Canal Zone anger.
You know, that's
anger
actually
stickers.
A palindrome if you...
Retrace Carter. The canal zone had been given back, but leaving a lot of U.S. troops in the area. And as Noriega tightened his hold on power, well, he did a few things. First of all, he started to traffic drugs more flagrantly.
Right.
Leading to actual indictments in U.S. courts.
And was part of the Iran-Contra scandal.
Exactly.
Right.
Of the Reagan administration.
This was the dawn of Seymour Hersh, too. Or not the dawn, but like... This was
Seymour Hersh did Vietnam era reporting, I think.
But this was one of his. This was one of his like later sort of expose, right? I mean, he did My Lay was his yes. like debut, but this was the dawn of him just sitting at like in his New York Times, basically being the
connecting pieces of yarn on a garage wall.
Yeah, the
right?
Ronan Farrow of his time, right. Just like, hey, guess what? Guess who called? It's Seymour Hersh.
So Noriega, in addition to his drug trafficking, was tightening his grip on power at home. He had lost a national election because he was just a massively unpopular, flaky character. They called him Pineapple Face.
Yeah, he had
acne.
It was mean.
He had acne. Just because this guy is murdering political prisoners doesn't mean you can make fun of his acne scars,
yeah, in my right. opinion. Yeah, no, you know what? Punch up.
Exactly.
Punched up.
Exactly. Like, Trump is fat, but it's not...
That's not why we hate him.
That's not why we hate him.
Oh, we don't hate him. No. You know,
Santa's fat and we love him.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
There you go.
So there's lots of reasons to hate Noriega. You don't have to call him. This. You don't have to call him Cara de
Pina. Well, he's also fat.
Yeah. Now I really hate him. Maybe you should be eating more pineapple. No, you know what? Instead of having a face
and
like
he's
one.
Short, like triple threat.
Oh, is he really short?
Well, he's not tall.
He's a squat guy.
That's right. Yeah. If he is actually tall, then he's got to be 4 feet across.
He had been soundly beaten in an election, and then the opposition pre-counted and saw that they had won, and so he nullified the election.
Good man.
And sent out what he called, this is one of my favorite, dignity battalions to just start beating up opposition protesters and leaders.
I mean, that's what I would have done.
Dignity battalions is very good. Like, it's got the kind of Orwellian thing where the thing means it's opposite. You know, the Ministry of Truth does. But really what he's saying is that what gives you the most dignity is to beat up your political rivals in the street.
Sure.
They're doing the undignified thing by voting for some lefty weirdo with a college diploma instead of the generalissimo.
I feel like dignity battalions are things that would appear in those like late 70s German porn movies where there was like always some sort of Nazi dominatrix and
like it's some lady slapping a riding crop on her hand.
Dignity battalion.
I'm going to take your word for it. The dignity battalions. When the U.S. started rattling sabers about these actual indictments in courts in Miami or wherever they were, he retaliated by sending his battalions after U.S. soldiers. Again, there's over 10,000 U.S. soldiers stationed in his country. You'd think that would worry him, but no, he just starts having them beat up on the street.
What, really?
Yeah, he doesn't support the troops, John.
Huh.
Female service members are getting groped and harassed and worse. There are about 100 of these incidents of these dignity battalion guys just roughing up some guy out buying souvenirs off the base.
It always astonishes me when a regional warlord
so confident
defies the United States to the point that the US is prepared to like go, you know, like tip over into cruise missile time. And whatever it is, whatever, because there are all kinds of dictators defying the United States all the time, but that they wouldn't be able to read the room and know, like, wait, they're going to rain bombs down on me if I don't, like, back up a little.
And the weirdest thing about Noriega is that unlike Kim Jong-un or Ahmadinejad or whoever, he literally has multiple U.S. bases in his capital city. You know, he's miles away from the nearest Delta Force, SEALs, Special Forces.
Right, like 1 mile away.
Yeah.
But he also has the phone numbers of like 25 high-ranking members of Congress,
He can call Ollie North's pager.
Yeah, just be like, all right. What is it going to take to like settle this all back down?
That must be what he thinks. He must think his connections with the Reagan-Bush axis is going to, you know, keep him safe. And this is all just saber-rattling for the press.
Right. Well, as we know, the Bushes like to keep America safe.
That's their number one thing they do for generations. In fact, the night of, you know, so a few days before Christmas 1989, the U.S. says, no, we're serious. We're going to invade Panama. And Noriega says, nah. And he goes off and gets drunk.
Wow.
When 30,000 U.S. forces arrive in Panama City, they cannot find Noriega. And it's because he happened to be hiding from his wife the night the invasion started.
Wow, this is a man after my own heart. This is what I would have been doing, too.
Is this what you would have done?
Hiding from my wife, and oops, an invasion started.
Maybe in your early era. So Noriega's off drunk in a, you know, so they surround the presidential palace, and he wasn't there. And his wife doesn't know where he was because he didn't tell her. He went off to get drunk in some rec center at a Panamanian Air Force base and had a sergeant go out and find him a prostitute.
Genius.
And when the troops come and he's like, oh, Bush was serious. He's dressed in a t-shirt and boxers and flip-flops, and he's running for cover. And he just heads for his secretary's apartment in the city.
Great.
He's like, they'll never look at Maria Elena's house,
right,
or whatever.
Right. Taxi.
And he's right. Days go by, and nobody can find the guy. So this is why it's perfect for cable news. So we've secured the Capitol.
Right.
Tell us what's going on the ground there. But Noriega has slipped through the net. He's elusive, that
he's
guy.
In a spider hole, except it's just a suburban apartment.
And because this is the pre-9/11 timeline, this all gets wrapped up for in 2 or 3 days. You know, on the next day, he makes it to the Vatican Embassy. A day later, we start, you may remember, we start
cranking metal.
Cranking, classic rock at the Vatican Embassy in violation of Vatican II. You know,
right, of course. Like it should have been Blue Oyster Cult.
Or, no, it should have been those Gregorian chants that were so popular in the 80s.
Einstein. It should have been
that, that one song, Sadness Part Zwei or whatever it was.
So wait, how did Noriega get to the Vatican? At what point did he make the transit from his secretary's apartment?
Oh, it was just easy. Nobody was watching his secretary's apartment.
Why didn't he just stay there?
Well, they were. At some point, they're going to, you know, his secretary doesn't have diplomatic immunity.
Right.
But the Pope does. So he's banging on the door, sanctuary, sanctuary, and the nuns take him in.
So I knew a guy who was in the army during this invasion, was in Panama. My sister's ex-boyfriend, Damien.
What did Damien do?
Damien was an infantryman and fought actually like fired bullets and like shot people.
Securing
strategic targets. And so I talked to him quite a bit about the invasion. And of course, he later became adjacent to alternative culture enough that he had lots of things to say about the invasion that confirmed our worst suspicions about.
I knew it.
The cynical nature of the.
We got Damien on our side now.
Yeah, Damien was one of us.
The detail that cable news loved, that we were blasting annoying music at the Vatican Embassy to try to get Noriega out.
Seems like, really? Are we?
I mean,
do we have no other angle?
The real victims are the nuns.
Yeah.
I mean, Noriega did like opera. He did not want to hear Styx. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the real story is pretty interesting. The reason why the PSYOPs guys who showed up started playing music at first is because there were American news media and international news media on the balcony of a nearby motel or something with, parabolic mics. And they were afraid that tactical stuff was going to be overheard.
Oh.
So they just started playing Steve Miller Band.
To
mask the sound.
You know, if they had played Kenny Loggins, like front to back, like greatest hits of Kenny Loggins, I think the war would have been over within an hour.
Well, they started taking requests. And every soldier would be like, oh, you know what would be funny? Like Strange Days by the Doors or, you know, Panama by Van Halen.
Yeah.
So at first it was all, or in every one of the play, Lee Greenwood, God Bless the USA. Mm-hmm. I have a playlist here.
Ballad of the Green Berets.
Let's pretend you're in the Vatican Embassy and you hear these songs. Which of these songs, I'll name a song and you say whether you stay or you go.
Okay, go.
You've got another thing coming, Judas Priest.
Into it.
Yeah, you stay. Blue Collar Man by Styx.
Totally into it.
Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins.
No, I want out.
We actually did play Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins.
That's three songs in and I want out.
You didn't last long.
No. That's, I can put my head under the pillow for the length of that song.
Dead Man's Party, Oingo Boingo.
I'll hang for that.
Don't Look Back by Boston.
Yeah, for sure.
Electric Spanking of War Babies, Funkadelic.
Yes.
I know, that's awesome.
This is a great party.
Playlist is amazing. I'm going to put this in my Heaven's on Fire by Kiss.
I'm not the biggest Kiss fan, but that's not a bad song.
I like that the Army and the Kiss Army are now the same.
Yes.
The Venn diagram has overlapped.
I've always said that as the Army becomes more and more motivated by metal and country western, that it will just end up being Kiss Army.
It's just a battle of whether the Juggalos or the Kiss Army takes over the U.S. Armed Forces first. If I had a rocket launcher, Bruce Cockburn.
Oh, okay.
This seems like they're just going by funny titles.
Right, but it's got to get, they've got to run out of funny titles pretty fast.
In My Time of Dying, Led Zeppelin.
Sure.
Iron Man, Black Sabbath.
Come on, this is great. We should be playing this for this episode.
The nuns are probably moshing at this point. Judgment Day by Whitesnake.
Oh, no, I'm back under the pillow for that.
A lot of songs with jungle in the title, because this is what the Army guys thought was funny. Oh, sure. Play Welcome to the Jungle. So Judgment Day by Whitesnake, Jungle Love by Steve Miller.
Totally into that.
Yeah.
Jungle Love.
Welcome to the Jungle, obviously.
Wait, but that's a different song.
And a lot of Paradise City. No More Mr. Nice Guy, Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Paranoid, Black Sabbath.
This is like it's when metal was still heavy metal rather than, I mean, I think these days you would just hear one Slayer song after another or some black metal from Norway. The guys would be, well, you know what they'd be doing? They'd be playing like hip hop.
Well, I think in Guantanamo, I think it was a lot of ironic. It was like the Barney theme, I think it is what we do now.
Oh, just play like the worst.
Just like imagine, like you have a kid, like three songs by the Wiggles over the car stereo. And I was ready to, I would have surrendered to Delta Force.
You'd give it up. You'd give up all the locations.
And obviously Renegade by Styx, Refugee by Tom Petty. You know, you can tell what they're, You Shook Me All Night Long. They're going for funny. This Means War by Joan Jett. The Party's Over by Journey. They're going for funny.
I was at this party in 1989. I just didn't realize that it was a military maneuver.
Yeah, you had no idea. And after a few days, I think Noriega realizes he's stuck in with nuns.
Yeah.
Like there's really no,
this is boring,
good way out.
He's going to be able to talk his way out once he gets out.
He walks out and, surrender, you know, me rindo a la fuerza de los Estados Unidos. He
do that more. Why don't you speak Spanish on every episode?
I didn't know you were, Jamie Lee Curtis from A Fish Called Wanda.
I just keep hoping you're going to switch over to Russian.
Nastrovya. like John Cleese on the plane. And so the invasion ends happily. The CNN audience applauds and switches back to VH1.
Right.
We become convinced that American invasions on TV are a great idea, which the Gulf War does nothing to change.
I was sitting, shaking my fist.
Just you and Damien are mad.
Yeah, I was listening to Refugee by Tom Petty, but totally mad.
But you've already mentioned what you know, people of our political stripe thought was one of the most pernicious things about this. Not just that it was on TV and had great ratings, but that it was called Operation Just Cause.
Just seemed so cynical, so
it's on the nose,
corny.
Just in case you're wondering if this was a just cause, hey, it's right in the chyron at the bottom of the screen.
Right.
It is.
And it made me feel like the people that get to name those things had no sense of humor anymore.
That was not the first name for the Panamanian invasion. It was originally called Operation Blue Spoon.
See, now that's a great operation name. Operation Blue Spoon?
You'd prefer that?
I think that's so cool. That sounds like a special ops. Operation Just Cause just seems like dignity battalion.
Blue Spoon, it's for no one, right? It's not for the public. Like you'd have to be one of the 20 insiders on the E-ring of the Pentagon who know what Operation Blue Spoon is.
I feel like I would write a song called Operation Blue Spoon.
The problem, yeah, it's not too late.
Yeah.
The problem is that during the run-up to the invasion, the Pentagon is getting more TV aware. General James Lindsay, commander of Special Operations Command, calls the operations officer, because there's a bunch of mid-level Pentagon guys who work for the Joint Chiefs who are coming up with these names. And he calls and says, do you want your grandchildren to say you were in Blue Spoon?
Yes.
See, but they don't think so. They think it sounds trivial.
Well, that's the thing about an operation
name. A secret name.
Yeah, you call it like Operation Candlestick, and it ends up being like the carpet bombing of 10 villages.
Well, here's the thing. Like those names go back to the Germans in World War I. They were the first ones to pick, you know, to say, you know, we're not going to call this the offensive to take
Operation 4.
To take whatever Berg, yeah, or right. Operation 4 or the date. We're going to give it a one-word name, and we're going to say this is Operation Kreuzberg or Barbarossa, right. Or, you know.
Operation Valkyrie, the plot to kill Hitler, was a great operation name.
And a great operation. Yeah. I mean, it didn't succeed,
right.
Obviously, in our timeline.
They'd call it Blue Spoon. Maybe we'd have a different outcome.
It's run by a guy with an eye patch. That operation has a lot to like about it.
So the Germans were the ones that started naming operations to keep them secret? Because if your operation is named Operation October 4th and that falls into enemy hands.
Hey, when's Operation October 4th going to be? It's counterintelligence. It's actually on February 30th, 29th.
Oh, February 39th.
on the 9th of never. So it was just, you know, German commanders planning the Western Front in 1918 who were the ones who kind of gave us the modern era by saying, no, this should be Operation Archangel.
I love that.
Just something from mythology. Like, you know, and thereby creating the Robert Ludlum, you know, the whole James Bond era we live in.
Sure, there are 2,000 paperbacks that would not have titles if it weren't for whoever those mid-level German commanders were.
I mean, they weren't the ones who decided you had to put initiative or ultimatum right. or something. We hadn't got to the second word yet, but they had figured that out. And so that caught on, especially, you know, Winston Churchill had written a 4-volume history of the Germans in World War I. And so he was very aware of how important this should be. And he had very strong ideas about what code names should be used in the Second World War.
So is this like Eisenhower figuring out the interstate highway system by watching the German Autobahn? Like Churchill came back and said, listen, I've figured out how to name operations.
It's going to be so cool. Check it out. And he actually wrote down principles and sent this to his generals. You know, this is the prime minister, and he's saying, hey, operations in which large number of men may lose their lives should not have a boastful or overconfident sentiment. Because you don't want to tell 1,000 moms that right. your son died in
Operation Never Fail.
Yeah, exactly.
Operation Your Son Lives.
They shouldn't be frivolous, because then you'd have to tell some widow or mother, Churchill noted, that her son was killed in Operation Bunny Hug or Ballyhoo. Like, it's got to sound good on a we regret to inform telegram.
What, Churchill said Operation Bunny Hug?
That's his idea of a no-go name.
Because that sounds like a greenlit Comedy Central animated show now,
that's
right?
That's the name of my improv group.
Operation Bunny Hug.
That sounds like you would like Bunny Hug. It's a Blue Spoon type. Its meaninglessness makes it perfect.
Well, but Bunny Hug isn't meaningless.
Oh, you think it's too
Bunny
cute?
Hug is cute, right? It does suggest, well, there's a lot of irony in it, right? Because if you're killing people and calling it a bunny hug, ooh, that's not what you mean, or it is what you mean.
The U.S. mostly started using colors, Operation Indigo, and then when they ran out of colors, the Joint Chiefs approved like a pre-written code word index that each theater got assigned blocks of cool,
right.
masculine sounding, common but not too common nouns. You know, you get, you know, the European theater gets market, Pacific theater gets flintlock, for example. And Churchill actually would veto names.
They'd come across his desk and he's like, no.
We are not doing soap suds, for example, which is what some American bomber raid on Romanian oil fields was going to be called. I'm reading from...
Boy, this seems like Churchill's down in the weeds about some stuff that he should be thinking at a higher level.
He should give that to an assistant.
No, soap suds, we're not going to do
that. Too many soap suds. We shall blood, sweat, soap suds, and tears.
I'm reading from an article by military historian Gregory Siminski, who in the 90s wrote kind of the definitive history of 20th century military operation naming. The Normandy invasion, which eventually was called... Overlord. Perfect name.
Yeah, that's heavy.
Because it worked. I mean, if it had failed.
You'd look like a real dummy.
Kind of a bummer.
Operation 500-pound gorilla.
But originally, the operation was going to be called, it was a combination of two plans that had previously been drawn up. 1942's Sledgehammer and 1943's Roundup.
Sledgehammer.
Yeah. You switched over to, you were doing Peter Gabriel before, right? And so as a result, they decided to combine it and it was going to be called Roundhammer. And Churchill absolutely did not want
Roundhammer's round pretty good, hammer. Although it sounds a little bit like some kind of Nordic, like a mythical Nordic town.
Yeah, you don't want to go too Germanic when you're invading, when you're hopefully getting all the way to Berlin.
Right.
The thing about all these names is they were only used internally. I mean, today we all know Operation Sea Lion never happened. Operation Overlord was a huge success. But at the time, these never made the papers, even after the fact.
Well, wasn't this part of your entry in the omnibus about the crossword puzzle revelations of all of these names?
Exactly. That's why it freaked them out that suddenly Utah and Omaha and Overlord are appearing in the Daily Telegraph crossword or whatever it was, because nobody was supposed to know these.
Although the name doesn't give anything away, but it did suggest like a...
That somebody's interpreting for someone else who might have part of the answer, yeah. But in the years following World War II, this naming gets a little more public, because obviously if you're already selecting cool names, it's a bummer that nobody gets to hear them, right?
Right, right.
The guy heading the A-bomb tests on Bikini Atoll, for example, was very, very carefully chose Operation Crossroads for the name. You know, it's the crossroads of the Pacific, but also it's the crossroads of a new era in warfare, et cetera, et cetera. He was very proud that he had thought of this, and he wanted to, you know, and he used it in Senate testimony. And so news articles began to include accounts of these words.
Right.
It didn't carry over in Korea. MacArthur just used the code word list, but when, so that's why you got like Operation Chromite or whatever, just a meaningless name. But when Ridgway replaced him, he decided this could be a propaganda tool, and he just chose very violent, aggressive nicknames: Operation Killer, Operation Thunderbolt, Operation Dauntless.
Right, like one of the bombing campaigns of North Vietnam was called Operation Rolling Thunder.
Well, this was the problem. In the Vietnam era, they decided to go the other way. Johnson started complaining that the names were too violent, you know, because now you got all these guys on the ground trying to one-up each other with their gung-ho names.
Right.
Operation Ripper, Operation Masher.
Right, and Operation Flaming Children.
And right. Well, that's the problem. LBJ's dealing with shrinking approval ratings at home. People don't like the idea of the war as visceral and violent. That's what's leading on the news. So he gets mad, and Westmoreland has to scale back the names to be a little more neutral, just proper names.
Right.
Operation Niagara still suggests a cascade of bombs.
Yes.
On the North Vietnamese, but it doesn't make us sound like bloodthirsty butchers.
Right.
It seems fun, like a honeymoon spot. After Vietnam, the U.S. practice becomes to semi-automate these names. A system called NICA is invented in 1975. That's the nickname for the code word, nickname, and exercise term system, the CWNAETS, which it doesn't spit out a nickname for your operation, but it's a database.
Now, the hurricane naming conventions, are those chosen by an algorithm, or does every year, does a committee sit down and say, this one's going to be called Lawrence?
Every year a committee makes a full alphabet, and they know they're not going to get to W, but they do it anyway.
Wow.
I think the big change there was that it used to be all women's names.
It should be, as God intended.
Well, I feel like it's important representation. How many storm gods in mythology are women? None.
Yeah, that's right. But all storm gods in America used to be, and now we've got Hugo and these things that are like, what?
I think the idea is it was
should be called Daphne.
It was considered misogynist to continue to associate a force of destruction with female energy. Hmm. Why not make sure every other one is Andrew?
Well, that hasn't been my experience in the dating world.
See, this is exactly the kind of hilarious Johnny Carson take that they are hoping to avoid by putting male names on the hurricane list. So what they did with what the military did with their naming operations is they divided the alphabet into sequences and assigned one of these two-letter sequences to the 24-component DOD agencies and commands worldwide.
This started in 75?
Yeah. So the U.S. Atlantic Command gets assigned. It's like the Dewey Decimal System. Mm-hmm. Okay, U.S. Atlantic Comm, you get AG through AL, ES through EZ, JG through GL. They get these segments of the alphabet, and they have to pick. And their segment ends with UM through UR, which is why they chose Urgent Fury, or some staff officer somewhere recommended Urgent Fury as the name for the Grenada invasion. They're going through a specific
Urgent Fury.
Think how urgent it was to invade and furious it was to invade Grenada in 1983.
Like, that's exactly when it starts sounding super dumb. Like, Blue Spoon is really cool. Urgent Fury, it sounds like a comic book, and by a comic book by an unimaginative writer.
But here's the problem. In the era of 24-hour cable news, who loved this stuff is news anchors who now get to sound like a Robert Ludlum book.
Right.
Every time they say, the Pentagon could not believe how often people started saying Just Cause.
Operation Urgent Fury.
Because they just thought of it as an internal thing where if anybody asks, it sounds cool. Right. Like, that's all they were thinking. They had no idea that these bozos on CNN, some guy doing a stand-up in front of an embassy is going to want to say Operation Just Cause.
Here I am in front of the embassy. Operation Just Cause.
We are in day three of Operation Just Cause. It makes them feel like they are,
right,
Delta Force operatives because they know the secret super code word.
You remember the war journalist character from Doonesbury who parodied exactly that kind of flak jacket wearing war correspondent who loved the jargon and who really situated himself in conflicts as a you know, somehow as a participant, even though.
Imagine the Pentagon pivoting from Vietnam era thinking where the liberal press is the medium to realizing how quickly they could co-opt these guys, yeah. You know? And you get the whole practice of embedding journalists because that's actually not dangerous. That's the best thing you can do because these guys love to feel like they are part of the troops.
And that's what we see in the first Gulf War is the complete neutering of independent journalists as they become just sort of, I don't know, embedded tools of the military. No one's allowed off the reservation, you know. Or so, I guess we don't say that anymore. No one's allowed off base.
Right? I don't know if it's a military base or a baseball base. But Just Cause is the pivot on which this turns, in which you know, CENTCOM realizes. See, I said CENTCOM and I felt so cool for a
that
second.
Is cool. I felt cool too. Say it again.
CENTCOM.
Say it in Spanish.
El CENTCOM. And they realize that this kind of contact coolness is incredibly valuable. And so a lot of thought starts going into how these things get named. It's not just one guy being like, hey, you know, Captain Lopez, let's not use Blue Spoon anymore. Think of something cool. Long conversations start to happen. Memos go back and forth leading into Desert Storm. That was not the original name for Desert Shield. It was originally Peninsula Shield because I think maybe PE was the right prefix. And Schwarzkopf didn't like that. It became Crescent Shield because they thought if you give it a Islamic symbol, sure. Our Saudi Arabian allies will see us as a force for good in the region,
sure.
And not a force of Western meddling crusaders.
But that didn't read very well either, not compared to Desert Storm.
Right. Once they realized how cool Desert Shield and then Desert Storm, and it had a sequel.
Yeah.
Like you could
Desert Storm
for
2.
TV viewers, it eventually had that. But Desert Shield turned to Desert Storm.
Yeah.
And for American movie franchise audiences, you were like, oh hell yeah, I love Desert Shield.
Yeah, let's up it.
Let's tune into Desert Storm now.
Crank the volume.
And one thing that happened very quickly is that all these foreign operations started to get this verb noun kind of a thing. Like, Operation Restore Hope.
Yeah.
Operation.
This just sounds like bad Star Wars
Preserve.
Prequels.
Absolutely. I don't even remember where all these were. Restore Hope. Is that Clinton in Somalia?
Yeah, maybe.
Promote Liberty. Uphold Democracy.
Stop it.
It just became like what you would think of if you didn't have an idea.
Well, and what's crazy about these, and the thing about the invasion of Panama was that it felt so much like an operation that was just a training exercise, right? That all of these, basically it was a training exercise, but everybody got real bullets. Like there was never a threat. If American troops got injured, it was just that they twisted an ankle in a hole, or maybe, you know, a couple of people got shot, but probably by accident.
And that became our baseline expectation.
Yeah, it really was.
That people won't get hurt.
But that we got to do.
Americans won't get hurt.
Americans won't. But we got to do all the cool stuff. We got to drop paratroopers. We got to have gunships. We got to have bombs. So it was just a way to like expend the ammunition that was about to expire in our ammunition dumps, right? Like, well, let's get all this stuff we're about to retire. Let's
blow this up in Nevada.
Yeah, one time around.
It's ominous to think that what led to the advent of drone technology was not so much the microprocessors that make it possible, but just the Pentagon realizing the public now demands this kind of bloodless war, entertainment right. War on our side. What are the technologies that we can advance to get us there?
Right. Five Americans die, and it's like we can't sustain these losses, but we can spend $30 billion, and nobody bats an eye.
This kind of propagandistic operation naming continues today. After 9/11, the immediate decision to invade Taliban-held Afghanistan was at first called Infinite Justice.
Like, boy, Churchill would really
you can't one-up it.
Stab out his cigar.
It's
on
like
that
a schoolyard thing where
Infinite Justice.
What are you going to say? Infinity plus one. I think it was actually American. It was, you know, the Council of American Islamic Relations or whatever. It was local Muslim clerics who were like, you know, they're doing the fingers to the throat thing.
Ixnay on the Ustis J.
Exactly. Like, this sounds like crusade rhetoric. And that's when it became enduring freedom.
Enduring freedom.
which really is the perfect name for an operation that is now, what, going into year 20?
Truly is enduring.
It has really endured. Good job.
Yeah. I mean, all of that naming convention, and particularly like Homeland Security, all that stuff just suggested the sort of anti-intellectualism of that administration and that whole era. Like, for anybody to say, yeah, Homeland Security, it sounded so...
And nobody there said, hey, have you guys seen Starship Troopers?
Yeah, it's like neo-Nazi sounding.
Yeah.
And, but to feel like that's the flag you want to raise, that was, I think, maybe a tipping point for me where I felt like there's a real dividing line now between an administration that would put like thought into making a thing not sound totalitarian versus an administration that would say, you know what, that name doesn't sound totalitarian enough.
This is maybe the kind of thing we should not be saying on the record, lest, you know, a Dignity Battalion show up at our door.
Well, you know, it's one of the reasons that I have fortified this compound, because there are a few Dignity Battalions I'm already expecting of the sort of 70s porn variety.
Well, they can't get in either.
And that concludes Operation Just Cause.
Just Cause.
Entry 869.EZ4510, certificate number 19345 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media exists in your era and that you've been a listener to Omnibus long enough that you can stand the sustained liberalism that we've exhibited in this episode.
It just makes me sick even to have to do it.
We're a couple of snowflake cucks over here with our anti-Bushisms. It doesn't mean that Ken and I are brainwashed progressives. Far from it. We're free-thinking individualists.
We're just not persuaded by the invasion of Panama.
Yeah. If you want to know more about us and our personalities, you can go to @KenJennings and @JohnRoderick. We keep it all going at Omnibus Project. I'm on Instagram, so you can see me. And in fact, I'm going to take a picture of you, Ken, and I'm going to put it on my Instagram. So if people want to go and look, they can scroll back far enough that they see that you're a real person.
They'll finally know. There's plenty of photographic evidence of me.
I guess that's right. Well, especially after your recent TV conquering hero status. Now your picture's on the cover of newspapers worldwide.
I really do think the odds just went up that there are now 50-foot statues of me all over the future. Some of them probably rubble. Hopefully sure. Others not.
Already in warehouses owned by tech millionaires.
Here stands Ozymandias, King of Kings.
You can email us if you have corrections or addenda. You can email us if you have MASH notes for us, if you have naming conventions for our episodes.
If you want to play a game of MASH with us, mansion, apartment, shark, like or
the
Hubble.
MASH game?
What is S? Mansion, apartment, well, you can write to us and tell us what the S stands for in the MASH game.
Oh, Wait. Match game or MASH game?
You've never played this?
MASH? No, what is it? How do you play it?
It's just an 80s Trapper Keeper thing. You draw a spiral.
Yeah.
And depending on where you stop the spiral, it tells you who you're going to marry and where you're going to live. And it's the most powerful form of divination ever invented by mankind.
Sorry, I never even heard of it. I don't think...
Ancient peoples used it to find fertile grazing lands and water.
No, I'm at a complete loss. Normally, I...
This might have to be its own Omnibus entry.
All right. Email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can go to our Facebook and Reddit fan groups under the Futurelings umbrella. You can mail us things at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. And if the mood strikes, support the show with a financial contribution at patreon.com/omnibusproject. There are lots of bonus materials available only to Patreon supporters. Ken is now opening mail.
We got a bunch of holiday cards that I didn't open in time that I'm now opening belatedly.
Oh, that's nice.
This Tess says that her cats Pippi and Buster often listen to us, but not her boyfriend. Come on, Bill.
Well, I think, Pat, you have a New Year's resolution, which is to get Bill to listen to the show and donate to us at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Jennifer appears to be some kind of yoga instructor.
Pass that card over here.
You keep the card.
Yeah, I don't need to learn anything about yoga, but I do need to learn about yoga instructors.
She sent us a bunch of Tillamook Creamery temporary tattoos, buttons.
The Canyon Crest Athletic Club. Let's see where that is. It doesn't sound like it's around here.
John just cares about his Canyon proximity to his Crest. Nearest yoga pants wearer. Athletic. But I'm interested in what she sent. Look, she sent us a Nestle Quick rabbit. Does the Nestle Quick rabbit have a name? I have no idea.
I don't know. Is he the one that kids can see or can't see?
That's Snuffleupagus.
Oh, Canyon Crest Athletic Club is... Oh, it's in the Inland Empire. I would have assumed it was somewhere down in Arizona, but it's really...
The next time you're in the valley.
Let's see here.
She also sent us...
Oh, wait, it is. It's in Riverside, California. It's not our Inland Empire.
Oh, no.
It's their Inland Empire.
I assumed you meant the San Fernando Valley when you said...
No, you know, Inland Empire is what we call that sort of Idaho, Spokane-dominated... like Eastern Oregon.
I've never had to refer
Montana.
To it. We call that the Inland Empire?
Inland Empire.
Yeah, I've been saying, I've never been, I don't know what to call that part.
Well, now you know.
We also got, she has sent us some Buckminster Fuller stickers. We each get one.
What's mine of?
It's Bucky saying, don't fight forces, use them.
Oh, and he's holding up his hand like he's using some telekinesis.
Yeah, he's a very old man and he appears to have powers in this, in this picture.
Not just powers to create like... uninhabitable
geodesic
70s
domes.
Home.
No, he's doing Jedi mind tricks on us right now. Listeners, futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived, given the escalation in military operation naming. The trend line is not great. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may be averted. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to return soon with another entry for you in the Omnibus.